Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly. Evolution does some pretty funky things.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
Achievement equals skill times effort.
That's the recipe for success. It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome, welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. Now, it's a call-in show, and if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, leave us a voicemail at 201-472-0785, 201-472-0785, or go to askbillnye.com. I am joined once again by science writer, editor, and my dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings, Bill. So nice to be here. Now, Bill, I know about your fondness for the movie The Wizard of Oz.
I do have such a fondness. That's a true fact, not a false fact.
To me, that always brings to mind Dorothy talking and singing about lions and tigers and bears. And, you know, they're fascinating creatures. This is a science show, and it got me thinking about the science of bears.
That's good, because today we have perhaps the world's foremost authority on the science of bears.
We have a bear expert.
Yes. Yes. Our guest today is Chris Morgan. He is a conservation ecologist and adventurer who is famous for his documentaries about bears. He even has a podcast called The Wild with Chris Morgan. Welcome to Science Rules. May I call you Chris?
Yes.
Now, my understanding is your mission is to reconnect people with nature and make conservation a social norm. So you're saying people are not connected to nature and conservation is not normal. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think I am. Yeah, it sounds like a big task, doesn't it, when you put it like that? But yeah, I'm really out to connect people with nature in some warm and wonderful ways, because once we do that, conservation follows, I think. And conservation's good for all of us, right? You know, we all need these wild places and the knowledge that there are wild animals out there and on a planet that we all depend upon. So it all kind of makes logical sense. But I don't think we're quite there yet, that's for sure, as human beings.
My concern as an environmentalist or science educator or whatever is that these charismatic megafauna, bears, lions and tigers, giraffes, zebras, get so much press that it leaves out the other species. But my understanding is your claim the charismatic megafauna are important.
Definitely. Especially with the family of animals like bears, I think, you know, everybody seems to have an opinion about them. You know, we grow up with them as we sleep with them in bed as teddy bears. And then later on in life, we're either petrified or fascinated by them and they become man-eaters or these iconic species we want to know more about in our imaginations, you know. So I think they're a really great family of species to bring people into ecology and animal behavior and conservation with, like any good charismatic megafauna. Bring them in, I always say, bring them in with grizzly bears, leave them with earthworms, you know, because they are a very, very much that. that but ecosystem
does that actually work? Do you find that you can convert people like, okay, if you like a bear, my God, you're going to love an earthworm.
Yeah, in some ways it does. You know, grizzly bears are prolific diggers, so half the food that they consume comes from underground, you know, so there are earthworms included in that for sure. And moths. A grizzly bear can eat 40,000 army cutworm moths in the mountains of the Rocky Mountains, you know, by pulling over rocks on talus slopes and lapping up all of this protein energy in the form of 40,000 moths a day. So
when you say moths, you're talking about larvae of moths?
No, these are adult moths that estivate, which is a daily hibernation, as you probably know, Bill. And this daily hibernation of these moths means that they gather underneath rocks, and the bears know that. And the moths are there during the day, so the bears will go up to these high talus slopes, pull over all these rocks, and underneath are these very sleepy moths, and they will consume literally up to 40,000 of them in a day, which is a huge amount of calories for them.
And so the moths must have some other role in the ecosystem.
Yeah, really important pollinators for those high elevation meadows.
So is it good that the bears are eating the moths?
Oh, darn it. Not for the plants, it's not, I guess. No, it's good for the bears. But then on the other hand, okay, ecology is so great, isn't it? So if the bears are eating the moths, that's not good for plant pollination. But bears actually do go on to become very important seed dispersers of plants in the form of their poop. So when a bear eats a plant that's gone to seed or eats fruit from berry shrubs, they then defecate in the forest over a wide area and they replant the forest and replant those plants.
Plus, it must be a source of nitrogen for all sorts of plants.
Yes, bear, definitely.
Feces and so on.
Yeah. In fact, that nitrogen source has been really important, for example, on the BC coast, just north of where I live here and on the Alaska Panhandle. Where they've shown
when you say BC for our listeners, British Columbia.
British Columbia, yeah, in southwest Canada here. I'm about 20 minutes from the border here where I live in the US. And that BC coast, especially further north, is really important grizzly brown bear habitat, as is the Alaska Panhandle. And there have been studies based on nitrogen that show that bear feces and urine are so packed full of nitrogen, it literally brings about 20% of the nitrogen into the system for that forest there. So it's literally bear poop and pee making those forests more healthy.
More productive. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this about bears. I think about what happened in Yellowstone National Park where, all right, let's eliminate wolves. Wolves eat our farm animals. They disrupt our ranching. And so on. So then when wolves were allowed to come back, somehow trees came back because the wolves were influencing the population of other grazing animals.
They were culling. They're doing a little culling.
That were eating the seedlings. So do bears have a role like that in the forest that you study?
They do. They might not be as vivid as the wolf example, because that is a really awesome one. And whenever I tell that wolf story, people just seem to be hooked. I think people are naturally predisposed to loving ecology, but they don't know it's called ecology. And that's part of my mission as well. It's like that whole wolf story, it's the best ecology story in the world, where they have impacted everything from bears, birds, butterflies, trees, shrubs. Some people say they might have even helped alter the course of rivers because they're altering the vegetation in the riparian area next to the rivers. So it's a really amazing example of the wolf's impact as a keystone species in a vast wild ecosystem like Yellowstone. There's kind of three categories that some or all of the bears in some cases fall into, and that those are indicator species, umbrella species, and keystone species. And some or all of the bears fall into any number of those, so they become really interesting ecologically.
Well, hold on. Break it down for us. What are those three different categories?
An indicator species basically shows that if a species is there, it indicates the health and vitality of an ecosystem. So if you've got a specific bear species in a specific place, it means that ecosystem is doing fairly well, because that bear wouldn't be able to exist if it wasn't a healthy ecosystem in terms of the food, shelter, water supply, and all the other things that it needs. A keystone species is a species that influences the ecosystem in a key way. The keystone being the wasn't the keystone stone the final block in the middle of an arch? Yeah, still is. Yes,
the keystone still is the keystone. Yeah, you take it out, it falls down. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Thanks for reconfirming that.
Yeah, they have a whole state. They created Pennsylvania all around that idea.
All that's about right. that. Yeah.
Thank you. God. Okay. So the keystone species is a clear one. Wolves are a great example of that in Yellowstone. And then umbrella species, I think, is the most powerful one for bears. You know, because the umbrella factor is if you protect a population of bears, you're protecting a large area, a large geographical area, especially let's take a grizzly bear, for example. So if a grizzly bear needs 200 or 300 or 400 square miles as a home range, you put a population of those bears together and suddenly it's a massive ecosystem. I live next to the North Cascades here and there's 10,000 square miles of grizzly bear habitat there. There may only be 2 or 3 grizzly bears left in it, though. They're highly endangered here locally, this bear population that I've worked on for a while. So if that population came back, though, and was protected in such a way that grizzly bears need, they play this role as an umbrella species, which means they are protecting that landscape and all of its resources for countless other species. So very much that umbrella kind of effect. And bears all over the world do that. Sun bears in Borneo, tropical bears, protect them, protect the rainforest. Polar bears, protect them, protect the entire Arctic. Grizzly bears, protect the Rocky Mountains, the whole ecosystem of the Rocky Mountains by protecting grizzly bears, you know. And if you ended up putting all the 8 bear species together, I did a back of the envelope literal scribble one day a few years ago and figured out if you put them all together, those 8 bear species, and you protected them, you'd be protecting 1/3 of the Earth's land surface.
Okay, so you know, we talk nowadays, a very common phrase, your origin story. How did you get interested in bears?
Yeah, a lot of kids love bears, but clearly something really stuck with you because you seem, if I may say, a little bear obsessed.
I am a little bear obsessed, Corey. Yeah, I'm English, so there have been no bears in England for 1,000 years. The Romans killed them off. The island was too small for Romans and brown bears there.
Why did they kill them off? Because they were interfering with their agriculture, they were eating people, there were trouble?
I think that they probably just competed for space that the Romans wanted. And Britain is a small country that was growing in population at that point, and it left little room for a big wild animal like a brown bear, a brown bear same as our grizzlies over here. And Romans finished them off. And Romans were scooping up the wildlife from all over the world to fight in the Colosseum and do battles with. They put grizzlies against gladiators in Italy. And you know, it was just kind of a strange relationship they had with wildlife. So I can only assume that Romans really felt like they were a competitor in some way for space or resources, and the bears lost. But as an English guy, it seems unusual to have a bear fascination, of course, but I came over when I was 8, this is my origin story, Bill. I came over when I was 18 years old to the States to visit and work on a summer camp in New Hampshire, in a little town named Berlin, New Hampshire. And I was there to work as a summer camp counselor with these kids, all these rural kids. And each week they'd have a different biologist come in to talk to the kids about their specialty. So one week a woman came in talking about her moose research. And then another week a guy came in talking about his coyote research. And then this bear biologist shows up to talk to the kids about his work. And I was the most fascinated guy in the room. I was only 18 at the time. I'm like, well, you can study bears. This sounds cool. So I bugged him for a couple of weeks. And in that 2 weeks, I just, you know, kept on phoning him and wanted to get out into the field. I asked him, can I come and see what you do? And I was fascinated by your story. And so he picked me up one night, and it was 9 o'clock one night in the pitch dark. And I thought, this is a little weird. He's picking me up at night to take me into the field to do bear research. So we
oh,
got
I'm sure
to the
it's
end.
Fine.
We got to the, I thought he's just trying to shut me up. You know, he's going to put me in a ditch somewhere. But we got to the end of the road of the summer camp. And instead of taking a right towards the forest, where I thought the bears would be, he took a left into the town of Berlin. And we pulled up at the city dump. And on the city dump, under this moonlight, there were 14 black bears, 14 of them. And I'll never forget the sight. And it just stuck with me. And his job was, as a biologist, was to tranquilize them and chased them around that garbage dump, radio collared them for his study. So I helped him that night. And
so you trank gunned 14 bears? Yeah. Or did most of them run away?
And I'm chasing them in the pitch dark.
Wait, this is your very first adventure as a high school student.
Yes,
as an 18-year-old.
Exactly. And that's 32 years ago now, and it obviously stuck with me, you know. It was one of you have those moments in life, don't you, where it was pivotal and it felt, I mean, I remember at one point it's pitch dark and we couldn't find this tranquilized bear and I knew it was in this garbage dump somewhere.
I mean, you shot it and the bear wanders around for a few minutes before it gets knocked out.
Yeah.
It's not a James Bond movie. This is real. It takes a few minutes, right?
It does, yeah. And they can cover quite a bit of ground in that time. So as soon as he would take a pot shot, I'd be off chasing the bear that I thought he'd captured, you know, flashlight in hand. And it was a very bright moonlight, which helped. But still, there were very dark patches of this forest because there were trees around it. And at one point, I just went really quiet in the darkness. And I just heard this. And it was a bear snoring about 5 feet away from my feet. I'm like, this is the best thing in the world. I want to do this, you know. So,
but weren't you bears have a reputation for aggression, for mauling you, for interaction where you come out the loser as the human. But you were into this.
I don't think I knew that at the time.
They're bears, for crying out loud. Dorothy is not going lions and tigers and moths.
Or lions and tigers and bears. Yes, I'd like to see some.
Lions and tigers and earthworms. Cool. No, well, come on. You had no idea that there was a potential danger? You must have.
I don't know. I guess the adrenaline took over. And I think that's why it stuck with me so much, that it was such an unusual situation. And I was so excited and so sort of beyond thrilled that I was out with this guy and doing this in the wild. And I'd always been obsessed with nature. Snakes and lizards and ants were my first thing, you know, and all the rest of it. Never did I imagine that I'd be chasing a bear around a garbage dump. And it was just, it hit me like a truck. I'm like, this is, I think, what I want to do with my life. It just kind of set me off on this journey to other places. I came back to Europe after that summer, a changed man. And I thought, where's the nearest bears to me? And they weren't in England. And there were about four in France at that time. And I discovered there were about 50 or 60 brown bears left in the northern mountains of Spain. And I loved Spain already. I'd visited there as a teenager and kid with my family and stuff. But I'd never knew that there were bears in the north of Spain. It's like, where have I been? I'm suddenly surrounded by bears, even in Europe. So I went to Spain looking for them and found a Spanish brown bear there, which is incredibly rare, in the Cordillera Cantabrica, this mountain range amongst oak trees. And so they eat acorns and beech nuts.
So the bears you've referred to, it's all sound like vegetarians.
Yeah, they are, a lot of them. Yeah.
Except eating moths isn't a vegetarian. No, that's
right. Not technically, is it? No. It really does depend. Take brown bears, for example. You know, there's probably 200,000 brown bears / grizzly bears globally around the Northern Hemisphere.
That's not very many.
It's not, is it? But then you get to somewhere like Spain, there's 200 now. That's become a success story since I was there for 60 or 70 of them 30 years ago. Now there's 200 plus brown bears in Spain. It's amazing. I was just in Italy. There's 50 brown bears in Italy. There's about a dozen in the Pyrenees in France. But wherever you find these bears, they specialize in different ways. They're almost like different local cultures of a brown bear. So whatever is it, actually the coastal brown bears we were just talking about is a great example. They focus on salmon when the salmon comes in. They've got access to all that high calorie food.
So they have different regional diets?
Yeah.
Regional bear cuisine.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Almost like humans in some ways. Hey, and very much the behavior relates to it as well. Coastal brown bears, let's call them brown grizzlies because that's what they are. Coastal brown bears are very well-fed, high-density population, used to evolving and growing in a community that's dense with bears, lots of them, shoulder to shoulder, the highest communities of bears in the world on the coast where there are salmon because there's lots of food for them. They're pretty chilled. I've sat 5-10 feet away from female brown bears and cubs, grizzlies and cubs on the coast. Now, I'd never do that in Denali. I'd never do that in Yellowstone. I mean, 200 yards is close for a female with cubs in Yellowstone. And it's because they don't have the habitat there. They don't have the high. So they've become more defensive in those interior ecosystems. Italy, they call them Uncle Bear in Italy. They've never attacked a person in Abruzzo National Park, the bears there. There's 50 of them 2 hours from Rome in a highly dense area of human beings. And so each of these sort of little communities of bears within even just one species is quite distinct in what they eat and how they behave.
Stick around for more science rules after this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Science Rules is back.
I was in Glacier National Park a few years ago, and there was a grizzly way, way up on this hillside. I mean, in English units, 2-3 miles away as the quadcopter flies. But everybody wanted to stay away from it. And a big thing is walking around with your bear pepper spray. And then bear bells, like you wear a bell, and the idea is the bear is going to hear you come in and go do something else. Do bears attack people?
They do. It does happen. And, you know, I'm a bear advocate and a bear lover and bear conservationist. And so, but I always try to stay realistic about it and honest. Grizzly bears do attack and kill people. It does happen. It's rarer than you might think from the newspaper headlines, because newspapers love great headlines, don't they? And so, you know, these bears are really just trying to mind their own business for the most part. And there are certain situations where you can run into a bear and where it feels pretty hairy. And usually when it's in the case of a grizzly, it's when you've surprised them. Mm-hmm. So you come over the brow of a hill, or so the bear you saw in Glacier Bill, if you'd come around the bend and that was the bear right there 20 yards away, you'd have a very different situation on your hands. If you'd surprised it or come over the brow of a hill and it didn't know you were there, its head's down in the berries. Worst situation, it's sitting on a carcass of an animal that it's killed and getting really defensive over. Bears get very testy in that situation. Or classically, female grizzly bears with cubs, defending their cubs.
Do the bear bells work, just wearing a bell?
I never recommend them. The best thing is the human voice. So to avoid this surprise, you want to make noise so that you don't have that sudden close encounter with a grizzly. So,
wait, Chris, have you ever been in a dangerous situation or yes, a situation where you felt out of control?
I've definitely been charged a bunch of times by brown bears on the coast of Alaska, but not physically attacked, but definitely charged.
What do you do?
Well, in this one situation, it was a little intense, because it was the breeding season. So that's we were there in early June, and the meadows there are full of bears, and the females
Where
are all.
Where is this now?
This is on the Alaska Peninsula, so in Katmai National Park. Across from Kodiak Island there, and Bear Central, and we filmed there a lot, and I've spent a lot of time among the bears there. It's amazing, because they're everywhere. And those bears, they're busy in June. The males are trying to find females, and the females, there's so many of them, are actually almost competing for male attention, which is quite unusual. Usually it's all fights between all males, but even the females are testy with each other. So it's just intense electric energy on these meadows. And I was there with my buddy Joe, who was filming. Joe Pontecorvo was filming for a project with us there. And this female comes running over this hill towards us. And we're like, whoa, this female bear looks like she's charging towards us, but didn't seem like she was charging aggressively at us. And I thought, it looks like she's running away from something else. And surely, sure enough, over the hill behind her comes this giant male bear, like salivating and just full of testosterone and hot pursuit of this lady bear. And she decides that she's going to go right behind us and sits down behind us about 15 feet away.
15 feet?
Yeah, really close.
It's not very far.
No, it's not. And so the females behind us, and they've learned that the big males are really nervous of humans here. There's a few humans that visit this place and go to watch bears. And the females, and even females with cubs, will use humans as a barrier. So this bear male comes over.
Wait a second, you were a human shield for a bear.
I guess so. Looking back, yes, we were, yeah. And so this male runs over behind her and suddenly stops in his tracks. And he's about 40 feet in front of us, and she's 15 feet behind. And he's chopping. They have all this really interesting behavior. So they'll jaw pop, which is like this sound of. So they're basically clamping their teeth together. And you can hear their molars basically doing that. And so that's one thing. And then when they're highly stressed, they'll salivate. And he was really salivating. And he sees his girlfriend behind us. He looks at us, looks at her, and then he just charges right at us. And when we got it all on film, I'm saying, "Hey, bear, it's okay, bear, it's okay, it's okay." And it worked. He ground to a halt, kicking dust up about 10 or 12 feet away from us. And
10 or 12 feet?
Yeah, it was pretty intense. And then he backs up and walked around us. But I think the point is that even a bear that riled up and that mad and that pissed that we were between him and his potential girlfriend still didn't want to have a physical altercation with us. He'll do everything to avoid it. And that's generally the nature of
bears. So what happened with the lady bear? He went around you?
He did, and on they went. the chase continued.
So I got to ask you about this. We're talking about conservation. You're talking about the U.S. You went to Italy. You went to Spain. Are some countries good at this, at conservation, and some are not?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, which is why it's important that we have these global policies through bodies like the IUCN, the International Association for the Conservation of Nature. There's even a bear organization, the International Association for Bear Research and Management, and it's made up of 600-800 bear biologists and people who are passionate about bear conservation. Because not every country is the same and not every country treats bears the same. Some countries persecute their wildlife, especially when it comes to big carnivores like bears and wolves, and I've worked in those countries. And others revere them.
What countries?
Well, and I don't want to point fingers at countries doing the wrong thing, because sometimes it's down to survival. In one situation, I was in northern Pakistan years ago, working on a brown bear population there with a team of amazing guys and trying to do two things. Research what the bears were up to, how many bears are there, why they're attacking livestock. And in this case, they were attacking the livestock of nomadic Gujar herdsmen. And their goats and sheep are everything that they've got. So if a bear kills one or two of them or steals the cheese, or, you know, these people want to kill the bear. So there's lots of retribution when it comes to these large carnivores. And that was a really tricky situation there. So I went and I was part of a team over there made up of a couple of unlikely guys who I thought were bear biologists before I got there. Come to find out, we sat down around the mess tent on the first day and one of them turns out to be a dentist and the other one was a chemical engineer. But they just loved bears and wanted to help them in their own country. And so I joined these guys and describing how a bear ticks and how they could avoid these conflicts with bears and why they're of value. And fast forward, I think just a few years later, this was 25 years ago that I was there, it became a national park, Deosai National Park in northern Pakistan. So there was a case of something where it was turned from a negative into a positive. The bear population is stabilized now, and it's all turned around.
I have a question that I think a listener is going to ask. Can we roll that digital recording?
Hi, Bill. Heather in Ohio here. I was just wondering if it actually does more harm or good to keep endangered animals in zoos and in captivity.
Zoos, good or bad?
Not all zoos are built the same. Really good zoos are really awesome and really important for conservation.
So what's an example of a good zoo?
One's on the doorstep here, Woodland Park Zoo. They support conservation all over the world. They're based in Seattle. They do in-situ conservation and also on-location conservation, meaning that they're doing conservation inside the walls of their zoo, but they take it outside as well. So, you know, they support conservation partners all around the world. San Diego Zoo, another awesome zoo. But then there are those on the list that are just basically, you know, captive facilities for animals to make a buck off visitors. But that's the other end of the spectrum. So, yes, they're super important.
What about preserving diversity, genetic diversity?
Yeah, a lot of these zoos are basically keeping the genes of the future alive for these species. So they play that critical role, totally, for sure. And then not to mention their educational value. You know, millions of people coming through the doors of those zoos that might never get a chance to go to Alaska and see a bear. I struggle sometimes to see bears in captivity, but when I look at the positive side of how they're being seen by the public and what the public are learning about them, and we do this thing at the zoo every year called Bear Affair, and it's super fun and educational. It's great for the bears. It's great for the people there. They've got these two giant brown bears, and we set up camps inside the enclosure there at Woodland Park Zoo and let the bears go at it. Because the camps, we've put sandwiches inside the tent. We've put coffee grinds everywhere. The stick of pepperoni under the pillow. Everything you're not supposed to do in bear country when you're supposed to stay safe.
They go after coffee grounds?
And they go for anything that smells, yeah.
When I was in the Boy Scouts, there was this myth, or it was common to say, don't keep chapstick in your pocket because bears love it. Is that true?
It is. Anything that
really?
Smells slightly alien. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything. I think it's petroleum-based, right? You know, so plastics they love. Anything that, you know, of course, something like toothpaste or candy or any kind of food, that goes without saying, but anything that just has a slightly different smell.
So you were talking about this idea of preserving genetic diversity. Earlier you mentioned, you know, 4 bears left in France or 60 left in Spain. Places like that where you have these tiny populations, there must not be very much genetic diversity left. I mean, do you need zoos and captive populations to keep those bear populations healthy?
Certainly for some species. And bears it's not too detrimental to bears when you have a limited gene pool. But for certain species, it really does have a negative impact on their ability to reproduce and produce fertile offspring, for example. So zoos are definitely important for that, yeah.
All right, speaking of zoos, polar bears are a charismatic, iconic species that are connected very closely with climate change. How serious is the situation with polar bears? Because, man, when you see them floating on that last bit of ice, it's just breaks your heart, right?
It's serious. Strangely enough, I was supposed to be in Spitsbergen right now this week.
In Norway?
Yes. Yeah. I guide expeditions up there each year, and it was this week, but because of COVID-19, we're not there. And it's really a front line for that sort of stuff. You know, you're able to see bears and how they're behaving and how they're being impacted. There is one location. There's another location that's a microcosm of what's happening to polar bears as well, and that is Churchill, Manitoba. Spitsbergen's one of the most northerly population of polar bears in the Arctic. And then in the subarctic, one of the most southerly populations of polar bears is Churchill, Manitoba. And the bears there, because they're so southerly, right on the coast of Hudson Bay, which creates its own weather system and climate, deeply, deeply cold in the winter, perfect for bears, but then warms up to the extent in the summer every year, more and more and more now, that the ice doesn't freeze quite as quickly as it used to. So it's leaving bears on land restricted, not able to get onto the ice and follow the ice because it's melting more rapidly.
So traditionally, polar bears would get on the ice, float around with the ice, hunt seals.
And so every fall/winter, the bears are on land waiting for that ice to refreeze in Hudson Bay so that when it does, they can get back onto that ice because it's the only place that they can hunt because they only hunt really effectively one thing. For all intents and purposes, polar bears are good at one thing, and that is snatching a seal from the surface of the ice, as my colleague Andy DeRocher clearly says. That's all. It's a really short resume. Just look at where they hunt and how they hunt. In the most extreme conditions on Earth, it could be minus 50 degrees in the middle of the Arctic winter, and they're out hunting seals. But not only that, it's pitch dark, remember, right? So they're hunting seals in minus 50 with nothing but their nose to find a meal, and it's pitch dark as well. I mean, it's incredible. So, and they also have this dark skin and fur, hair that is hollow, translucent. So it almost gives this yellowish sort of glint with the sun shining through it. And that helps insulation and it helps them float. It makes them such great swimmers. Everything about a bear is just finely tuned.
Science Rules will be right back.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You're listening to Science Rules.
We have an email from somebody in Montana. The person writes, "Hey, Bill, in Montana and Idaho, we have a lot of ranches. We also have the highest number of bears and wolves in the area. A lot of people in these states want to eradicate them, wolves especially. I was wondering what effects this might have on ecosystems in Idaho and Montana, and if there's a better way to defend one's livestock and our predators at the same time." And you got an idea there, Chris?
That's a really good point. And they are divisive in some ways, these species, right? There are people that love them and will do anything to protect them, and there are those that loathe them and want them gone. And I've worked quite a bit with wolves as well. And in fact, one of our we just did a podcast on wolves here in Washington State that focused on a guy named who's a range rider. And he's for all intents and purposes, looks, smells, walks, sounds like a cowboy, but he's a guy who's on the side of the wolves who works with ranchers to protect their cattle from.
What, he has a business card that says range rider?
Yeah. Isn't that the coolest?
Oh, yeah. What is it? Okay. What does he do? He rides a range.
He rides the range on horseback. He's got, in this case, his name's Dan Curry. In this case, he's got three Doberman Pinscher dogs that he's training to work around wolves. And he keeps the cattle safe from wolves and keeps the wolves safe from people who don't want them there. And sometimes that's the ranchers.
How does he do that?
Because they threaten the ranchers' livestock. Mostly through diplomacy, honestly, with both the wolves and the ranchers. So he'll sit down around a fire pit and drink beers with ranchers and talk wolves and the reality of them and try and bust the myths because there's so many out there. And then he'll literally walk around. The profession has been around for about 3,000 years, I think. You know, it's called a shepherd. He's basically a shepherd when it comes to protecting the cattle from the wolves.
And so he talks to the wolves. Do the wolves sign treaties? How does this work?
Just the sheer presence of someone on the landscape around cattle will keep the wolves away from them. And then there's other things. There's flagging that people use to distract the wolves and keep them away. Some wolves are radio collared so they can be monitored. But it's not always easy. And to Montana and the question there, I mean, it can be intense. There's a good number of wolves over there, and there's a rebounding population of grizzly bears. And for conservation, that's been great. But for people who make a livelihood on the land, it's not always easy.
Do people also just have to accept a certain level of loss that's just going to happen anyway, a certain level of livestock loss?
Yeah, I think it's invariable, Corey, because it's going to happen. Large carnivores and cattle or sheep on the landscape are not an easy mix.
We have a caller. Let's roll that digital recording.
Hey, Bill. This is Mike from Redwood City, California. The pandemic caused many national parks to shut down, which allowed much of the animal life to become more lively. Parks are now reopening, and these lively animals will experience more human contact again. Will these drastic swings in interactions do more damage to preserving the wildlife compared to pre-pandemic conditions? Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
What an awesome question. Yeah. You know, when it comes to bears and other highly evolved mammals that are super smart and used to working their way around any number of obstacles in their lives through the daily course of their lives, humans are one factor, right? And thankfully, most of these species are now co-evolving and evolving and growing in a world where humans are a big part of their landscape. So they adapt very quickly to it, whether we're there or not. I mean, right down to sort of the micro level is kind of, you know, the studies that have been done on trails in Alaska that are heavily used by grizzlies and heavily used by humans. And the grizzly bears, remote cameras watched this. Grizzly bears will just come off the trail, let the human walk by, and then politely come back onto the trail and go about their day. They work around us all the time. So the bigger scale of COVID-19 definitely is allowing them to breathe a little easier, have more space, be interrupted in their feeding less, be interrupted in their raising young cubs if they're a female grizzly bear, for example. Definitely they're breathing easier right now. But the reopening of it and resurgence of humans coming in, as long as we're smart and as long as the rangers are able to do their job and keep people out of danger and from doing crazy, stupid things which people can do around wildlife, then the wildlife will adapt around us.
All right. So you're inferring or think you understand what a bear is interested in doing. Bears feeding, bears doing anything. Is there any evidence that bears like to see the humans go by? You know, they're fun to watch. Because I say it because we like to watch wildlife. And you know, you can't beat if you're in a room and there's a baby or a dog. Everybody wants to talk to the dog. Do bears do the same thing with humans? Is there any way to figure that out?
I think I have figured that out, Bill. I've got an amazing experience to share with you. One day I was up in Alaska, on the Alaska Peninsula, back in Katmai National Park. I had a small group of friends with me, about five or six of us. And I wanted to take them down
this valley.
Started
out with six, came back with five. It was bear country. Stuff happens.
They were slow and old. What can I say?
You got to adapt to a little bit of loss.
My friend always used to say, 10% attrition. Come on. You know? Yeah.
What? What's the big deal? So go ahead. So there you are.
I wanted to take them down this valley where I knew there was a wolf pack. And I wanted to teach them how to howl for a wolf. So it being Katmai National Park, we get to this little Brava Hill where I thought our sound would carry. And there's a giant brown bear sitting down about 30, 40 yards away from us. Just mind his own business, literally just sitting in this little gravel bar. And the bear's looking at us and almost like, oh, didn't expect to see you here kind of thing. So definitely observing us. Well, I teach these people how to howl. We do this. This wolf comes out of the alder thicket onto its own little gravel bar. And the people I was with were blown away. They're like, oh my God, it worked. We howled
this
and this wolf came out.
Yeah.
But the most amazing thing to witness was the bear. The bear looked at the wolf like as surprised as we were to see the wolf. Then the bear looks at us like, that's amazing. Then looks back at the wolf. It was definitely this bear watching us and processing. Those are humans. That's a wolf. But they're communicating. And he was as blown away as we were.
Okay, here's the thing. If you were king of the forest, Chris, Mr. Morgan, if you were running the show, what is it you want everybody to know about bears?
Well, that they are incredibly intelligent, incredibly patient. One of my colleagues described them as patient to me once, and I'm like, that's so perfect.
They're bears. Who's going to mess with us?
They really
are. We're bears.
But we are, God, they've been through some persecution at our hands, though. I mean, they've been around their ancient ancestors, 5 million years. And, you know, we owe it to them to leave space on this planet for them. But at the same time, that space that they need is the space that we need. Because in that space is the fresh water, the natural resources, the clean air. Everything that we need as human beings can be protected by bears, by us looking after their needs. And honestly, it just seems like it's the right thing to do. I'm always trying to figure out, back to this reconnecting people with nature, it's almost like, how can we change our perspective of what these creatures are? And that they have an inherent right to live on this planet, just as any of us do. That it's our planet along with them. It's their planet along with us. And I think there's deep power in that that is really good for humans as well.
So you recommend having what would be parks? Like, bears can live here, we're going to live over here.
You just hatched an idea here today, Bill. That's awesome. You could have international bear parks based on a specific species in specific countries around the world, all around the 8 bear species. That protect the core habitat of those bear species, and it's called an international bear park, for people to go and visit, understand, not for people to be excluded from, but for bears to run the course of their natural lives, right, and just operate as part of the ecosystem like they were intended to. I think it's a lovely idea.
The Bill Nye International Bear Park, yes.
They would watch us, we'd watch them, we'd take meetings, you'd be out there calling wolves.
It sounds idyllic.
Corey, do you hear that sound?
Bill, sound of thunder means lightning, and lightning means lightning round.
So, Chris, this is the lightning round. We ask you a question, you give us your quick answer. Here we go. There are only 8 species of bears, right? Can you rank them from worst to best?
In terms of what?
Your call. You decide.
In terms of quality. Like, what's the highest quality bear and what's the lowest quality bear?
Got to be grizzly bear first. Got to be polar bear second, I would say.
So what's the worst bear?
Worst bear. Oh, God, there's no worst bear.
No, you just love them all.
I do. I love them all. Yeah.
There we go. Okay. What's your favorite nature documentary that you did not make?
Planet Earth.
Planet Earth. There you go. In 30 seconds or less, what should you do if you encounter a bear on a hiking path?
Depends on the circumstances and the bear's behavior and the bear's species. If it's a sudden encounter with a grizzly bear, play very deferential, back away, talk slowly, calm the bear down, calm yourself down. If it's a black bear that's pursuing you deep in the backcountry and he means business and he attacks you, fight back for all it's worth because he's acting predatorily.
And so you just fight back and he'll give up after a while after he has your arm or what have you. Yeah.
Yes. Maybe I shouldn't have answered that way because there's a lot of nuances to it, but I don't want people to get into trouble. But
right. So you could easily pick the wrong course of action if you don't know what kind of a bear you're dealing with.
Yes. Yes. If it's a brown, fall down. If it's a black, fight back. There's even a little rhyme for it, you know.
Oh,
so,
wow. There you go.
But there's nuances of that as well. So don't take it for rote.
Let me ask you this. There are many. I had teddy bears, one of whom, Pixie, wore a bow tie. What's your favorite fictional bear?
Oh, Paddington, a Peruvian spectacled bear. Yeah, and I've spent time with my friends who study those bears, and they're amazing. Yeah, so definitely Paddington.
Now, if you could, would you want to become a bear?
Oh God, yes.
And what would you do as a bear?
If I could be a grizzly bear for 24 hours, I would die a happy man. My brain would explode because the nose of a bear would just, I think, flip my synapses out. It's more than any of us can even conceive what a bear's nose is capable of.
But wait, only for 24 hours. What if you had to kind of commit to the long term?
I would still be grizzly.
It's grizzly all the way. This is fantastic. Chris, thank you so much. Our guest today has been Chris Morgan, adventurer, wildlife conservationist, and check out his podcast, The Wild with Chris Morgan, where he he gets you engaged through audio with nature. And remember, everybody, when it comes to lions, tigers, and especially bears,
science rules.
If you like Science Rules, and I hope you do, please take a moment to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. Helps us out, helps us learn who is listening and what you want to listen to. So thank you. Be sure to look at our socials for information about our upcoming guests. I'm at Bill Nye on everything. Meanwhile, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, and I hope you would, give us a call at 201-472-0785, 201-472-0785, or submit a question at askbillnye.com. Science Rules is produced by Harry Huggins and our very own Corey S. Powell. Casey Halford mixed this episode and composed our original theme. Josephine Martorana is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is the chief content officer, CCO, here at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, everyone, Corey, you ready?
Science Rules!
Stitcher. Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.